Well, welcome all to another Weber Training Teleclass. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to welcome you to the teleclass, Effective Presentation of Infection Control Data. Now, I've been really looking forward to this presentation for some time. Our faculty, Bonnie Bernard, gave this same lecture at the APIC conference in Baltimore a couple of months ago. I tried to attend that lecture, but so many others had shown up that the room was full to capacity and they were actually turning people away. Now, Bonnie Bernard is tremendously committed to the infection control community and tremendously busy. She has been an APIC board member. She helped to author the APIC Chica Infection Control and Epidemiology Professional Practice Standards. She authored an APIC e-learning course. She has published in the American Journal of Infection Control, the Pediatric Infectious Disease Journal, and several others. She speaks often to professional groups, and she speaks very well. And it is a real honor to have her with us today. So to present the teleclass, Effective Presentation of Infection Control Data, from St. Peter's Hospital in Helena, Montana, it is my pleasure to introduce Bonnie Bernard. Bonnie.
Thank you, Paul. You do me more justice than I deserve, probably. This is my first teleconference for all of you out there, so I'm going to be learning a little bit about the process as we go here. So I understand that I have to say next slide when I have the slides, and I'm assuming that everyone has a copy of the slides that I'll be talking about. First thing I want to do is just give you a little bit overview of what we're going to do today. We have a lot of material. I will talk very fast. I'm going to give you a warning ahead of time because some people don't know that I talk fast normally, but because of the material, I do talk a little bit faster. What we're going to do today is we're going to talk about the process of transforming data into information and knowledge and what that actually means. Sometimes we talk a little bit about using data, but what we're trying to do is really use information. The second thing I'm going to try and do is cover the components of a well-designed data display, and you'll see several examples in the handouts as we go through. Talk about the factors to consider in the process of designing a meaningful report, which is always our challenge in infection control, is trying to take the information that we get from our databases and turn it into a report that means something. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the issues related to the use of comparative or benchmarking information, but mostly what I'm going to be talking about is the whole process of surveillance and turning that information that you collect in your surveillance processes into reports that people can use and people will actually take action upon. So the next slide is, what is surveillance? And I want to just kind of review the definition of surveillance. We're all in infection control, we probably know, but just as a reminder, surveillance is the systematic method that we use to collect, consolidate, and analyze data regarding the distribution and determinants of disease. In our particular domain, what we're collecting data on or doing surveillance on is nosocomial infections, which are considered adverse events. The second part is the dissemination of that information to those that can change the results. And that's the part that sometimes we may fall down on. And I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that. So that's the basic definition of surveillance, which I think all of us are very familiar with. Next slide is recommended practices for surveillance. These recommended practices for surveillance come from a paper that was published in the American Journal of Infection Control in 1998, the Surveillance Initiative Working Group of the Association for Professionals in Infection Control got together and developed a document which actually describes the steps in the process of surveillance. And if you are new to the field and you are not familiar with this document, I would highly encourage you to get this document off of the APIC website because it does really very systematically go through what are the steps in surveillance and how are those steps to be done. In summary, basically, you want to assess your population to see what kind of surveillance you should be doing. The second step is to select your outcome or process to survey. So basically what we do in our hospitals is decide what kind of surveillance we're going to do, whether it's bloodstream infections, total health surveillance, surgical site infections, one type of infection in a particular unit or intensive care unit. The third step is to apply surveillance definitions. For those of you that have been in infection control for a while, you know that this is very important. If we don't apply consistent definitions to what event we're actually collecting data on, our data is not valid. It's not valid from an intra-rater reliability standpoint, and it's not valid when we're trying to develop comparisons among different sites in our hospital or between different facilities. So that is a very important step in making sure that we use appropriate surveillance definitions. Most hospitals use the National Nosocomial Infection Study, or now NHSN, definitions for these infections, and that's probably the gold standard for the definitions of infection. Fourth step is to collect that data, and that can be done in many different ways, and we'll talk about that in a second. Fifth is to calculate your rates and analyze your surveillance findings. And rate calculation is a whole lecture. We could spend probably a whole hour talking about how to calculate rates and what's appropriate for what type of data. We also want to apply some kind of risk stratification method, particularly if you're trying to compare between groups. In surgical site infection surveillance, we look at a combination risk score that includes the anesthesia score, the class of the wound, and the length of time of the procedure, but there are other risk stratification methods that can be used. And finally, but most importantly, is that we want to report and use our surveillance information. So once again, if you're interested in more detail about those recommended practices for surveillance, you can get that paper from the Surveillance Initiative Working Group off the APIC website. Next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about the data model. The goal of presenting data is basically to create wisdom by converting that data, which is numbers and figures, into some information that can then be translated into knowledge and into wisdom. An example of data is that you have 5 surgical site infections in your orthopedic service. That's just data. There were 5 infections. When you translate that to information, you're actually starting to calculate rates, which kind of smooths out the information, gives you a little bit of comparative information. And then when you translate it to knowledge, what you're doing is taking that rate and evaluating that information in some kind of a context to give it meaning. So for instance, if you're comparing your surgical site infection rate to the NIST rates, you've now translated that rate, which was just information about your site, into some knowledge based on experience that other people have had with surgical site infections. And then the last thing is to apply your experience to knowledge to solve problems. So that's more advanced infection control practice, where you're actually looking at your rates, looking at them in the context of what other people's rates are, and then taking appropriate action to decrease those rates. So that's sort of the data model. This is a model that's been published in the APIC text and is widely used to kind of talk about how you transition those numbers into something that's useful and has an impact on healthcare. Next slide, I want to discuss a little bit about why do we want to analyze, display, and report data. Well, first of all, we want to be able to track and trend information over time. We want to look for seasonal occurrences. Many times there are certain types of infections that occur in certain times of the year. For instance, chickenpox in my area of the country usually appears in the springtime. RSV occurs in October. You want to look for outbreaks. You also want to look for sentinel events, things that you would not expect to occur normally. For instance, in my facility, if we see a group A strep infection, surgical site infection at all, just one case, that becomes a sentinel event that we want to investigate to see what the source of that infection is. The second reason you want to do this is to benchmark or compare yourself to others. This helps you to detect areas for improvement, and it also helps you to decide what areas that you want to have performance improvement projects on or to improve your performance. On the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about the toolbox and how you get the surveillance done. Just as an overview, there's 4 things that every infection control professional or anybody that's doing surveillance will have in their toolbox to use for doing their surveillance. The first thing is you need to have some kind of case finding and marker tools. The second thing is to have collection and storage tools for the data. Third is some analytic tools. And then the fourth is presentation tools for actually presenting that information. For those of you that are Joint Commission accredited facilities, One of the standards that you probably should be familiar with, which isn't always talked about specifically in relation to infection control, is that the Information Management Standard 4.10 talks about using information for decision making. And one of the evidence of performance levels in that standard talks specifically about infection control, and that really talks to this whole issue of taking the data that you have, transforming it into a format that's understandable by others, and then using it to intervene. So if you're not familiar with that standard, you might want to look that one up as well as the infection control standards. On our next slide, I want to go into a little bit of detail about case finding, finding your cases. As all of you know, we do it, everybody does it a little bit differently depending on what your data sources are in your facility. But this is the process of finding potential nosocomial infections. And this is probably the step that we spend a lot of time on in infection control. If we are highly automated in our facilities, this is much easier. If we are not highly automated, like in my facility, things are not computerized to the level I would like them to be. I do a lot of manual review of multiple data sources in applying the definitions that are in my head to identify potential nosocomial infections. There's the manual way, and then there's the data mining software, which I'll talk about in a little bit, which can help you do that in an automated fashion. We get our data from many sources, and I'm moving to the next slide at this point. We get information from the laboratory in terms of microbiology cultures, AFB smears, PCR testing that's done in the microbiology lab. We also use serological information from the lab, HIV, hepatitis, influenza, RSV. And as the technology for diagnostic testing changes, so does our surveillance methodologies with the data that we get from the laboratory. So it's really important to make sure that you stay up to date on what diagnostic techniques are being used by your laboratory, if that's a primary source of information for you for your surveillance, because those techniques are changing, seems like, on a daily basis these days with all of the different types of tests that are now available for doing quick types of testing. It is estimated that in 10 to 15 years, the plate in microbiology will be history. Most of that testing will be done with DNA and RNA technology. So that's just something to kind of keep an eye out for and make sure that you're up to date with what they're doing in your lab. We may look at contaminated cultures in the context of, for instance, if we saw a lot of bronchoscopies that had contaminated cultures, that might drive us to do certain things. There's data that we get from the operating room, which is mostly denominator information for our surgical site infection surveillance. Some people get flash sterilization statistics from their OR, and then related to some of the projects that we do in the United States, we have to keep track of antibiotic prophylaxis compliance. Either the infection control program or also the pharmacy can do that work. We use employee health data related to exposures to communicable diseases and bloodborne pathogens, employee illnesses. Respiratory care data can be in terms of looking at ventilator-associated pneumonias and having our respiratory department provide us with those denominators in terms of vent days. And then lastly, the emergency room is a wealth of information in terms of trying to track emerging infectious diseases, looking for post-operative infections or syndromic surveillance to deal with the bioterrorism type issues. The next slide, I want to talk a little bit about data mining. For those of you that went to the APIC National Conference, you saw a lot of vendors there that are providing a software capability now that actually helps you with your surveillance. And if you look at the picture there, you can see this woman that's like behind reams of paper, which kind of looks like my desk right now. This is the paper that we go through every morning to figure out what it is that we're supposed to be doing for the day. Most of the infection control professionals' time is spent sifting through data unless you are in a facility that is highly automated. That time takes us away from the interventions that we really should be spending most of our time on, the teaching and the performance improvement projects, the just-in-time teaching that we can do when we're out with the staff. The more computerized infection control becomes, the more time we should be spending on these interventions. We shouldn't be sitting at our desk trying to do our programs from our desk. The rubber hits the road out in the clinical areas. This data mining surveillance software, what it provides for people is it takes away this time that you spend looking for infections. There's been a lot of talk about catching things that we wouldn't normally see. Algorithms are built into this software that help people identify problems that they may not even know that they have. some of the examples of some of the names of the companies, there's companies Theradoc, MedMind, Seraplex, and Vecna are the four that I'm familiar with. There may be other vendors out there. I'm not meaning to sound like I am pushing any of these programs, but in a large facility where you're having to sift through a lot of information, it is possible that a program such as this could actually make a significant difference in terms of the time that you can actually be out there doing interventions and less time sifting through information. There was one hospital, as an example, 158-bed hospital that used one of these programs. They had a 20% reduction in their hospital-acquired infection rates during the first year of use, which saved the hospital $1.1 million in unreimbursed costs. These programs are typically what happens when you're wanting software for your infection control program. You're talking to your supervisor, whether that's the director of nursing or if you report to the lab or quality or CEO. The sale of this product is really, these products is really best made to the CFO because they really have a significant financial impact on the facility. If you look at the next slide, it's just an example of a control chart that's created through one of these packages. Basically, this particular software looks at isolates, and this particular facility wanted to monitor Aspergillus. And what the chart shows you is what the actual number of isolates is, and then what the upper control limit is for each one of those points. And if you look across there, you can see, I think it's on December 11th of 2004, they had a peak. Now, if you're doing standard surveillance, but where you're actually doing this manually, you may never see those peaks until it's too late, until you see a problem. So what these programs are designed to do is to actually detect problems, the area where you don't know that you don't know. So they can be useful for those kinds of things. If you look at the next slide, we're looking at Staph aureus isolates and methicillin resistance on this particular graph. You know, what this is helping you do is to see trends. We can see the individual data points many times, but we can't see the trends, and it helps you to identify problems early before you have big problems that you have to solve later. So if you're in a large facility where you're sifting through a lot of microbiological data on a daily basis, this is something that you might want to look at in terms of trying to detect your infection control problems early. It takes away a lot of the clerical function so that you can focus more of your time on intervention. There was an article in Modern Healthcare, the magazine Modern Healthcare, in April of 2004. This particular publication is targeted towards CEOs, and it was a very good article that talked about savings that can be realized as a result of getting these packages for the infection control program. And I was happy to see that because the target for the sale, as I said, is senior management team. So let's move on to collection and storage. There's several tasks related to collection and storage, entering data, warehousing it, and looking at data relationships. There's infection control specific software that you can buy, for example, ACE, EpiInfo, EpiQuest, and SoftMed, and there's other packages that are out there also. You can use off-the-shelf packages like Access and Excel to do the same types of function. One of the things that you have to keep in mind when you're looking at collection and storage is whether you want data collection tools that are specific for a particular infection site versus a multi-use tool where you're collecting information on multiple sites of infection. Whether you want to have a case form, whether it's electronic or paper, the case form, which is specific to one site of infection and you're collecting risk factors on that particular infection versus a line listing. In my facility with an average daily census of 60, I use a lot of line listings because I don't have that many infections. It's not advantageous for me to collect a lot of detail on my infections. We also need to have some kind of a tool that you can use for numerator and denominator data. And then you have to make some decisions about whether you're going to use a paper tool, if you're going to use something where you do direct data entry, something like a Palm Pilot or a laptop computer, or if you're downloading information from other computer systems in your particular facility. And the data that you want to collect obviously is going to be related to your surveillance plan, key processes, high risk, high volume, things that are problem prone. Looking at the time intensiveness to collect, sometimes you have to take a step back and look at if it's going to take too much time to collect this data, it may be more important just to make sure that process interventions are in place and not worry about measuring outcome interventions. Moving on to analysis, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but there's lots of analytic tools out there. This is where you're doing your rate calculations, any kind of statistical calculations, chi-squares, calculating p-values and using t-testing and those kinds of things, and looking for trends either with control charts or with run charts. On the tools that can be used, once again, you can use those off-the-shelf tools like Excel. You can use statistical software like SPSS and SAS, which is for more advanced infection control programs. And then the infection control surveillance softwares, ACE, EpiInfo, have some kind of an analytical tools built into them. I want to move on now into talking about how we summarize data and how we display the information. There's different ways that we summarize data. We can compare things among categories, and we use a certain type of chart for that, which would be bar charts, pie charts, and Pareto charts. If you're looking at frequency of events, we're going to use rates, ratios, and proportions to do that. There is variability analysis where we're looking to see how far away, how much variation there is in the data. And we'd use measurements like means, medians, and modes, ranges, and standard deviations. And I can hear you all quivering out there when I say statistical, because it kind of gets people, gets the fur on their back up a little bit if they have not had a lot of experience. But there are a lot of tools out there now that you can use to do those kinds of things for you. You simply really only have to understand what the measure means. You don't have to do the long calculation. And then lastly, there's some variability analysis that you can do in a graphical format with line graphs, histograms, and control charts. One thing I just will kind of give you a caveat about is be very careful about using averages and means for all of your measurements, because by themselves are sometimes not a good summary of the information that's contained in a set of data. If you've got a lot of variation in your data, that measurement may not be a good thing to use by itself. Moving on to the next slide, I want to talk a little bit about presentation. Presentation, the tasks in presentation are generating the reports, creating some tables that actually represent the information, and then finally creating graphs and charts. And there's, once again, different software tools that you can use for presentation, and you have to look and see what would be appropriate for your setting. Now we're going to talk a little bit about how we transform this data to information. If you look at the next slide, you'll see an example of a line list. And this is kind of the standard thing that most infection control professionals have learned, either in their surveillance classes or from other ICPs. If you look at this, you can see that, you know, there's a name, there's a medical record number, identification, age, admission date, culture site, and organisms. One thing to remember when you're creating tables, especially if you're using a product like Excel, you want to make sure that your data is coded. So if you're putting MRSA in your table, you want to make sure that you always have MRSA and not have it as MR sometimes or MRS, because when you're trying to do your analysis, it'll make it a little bit harder for you to do that analysis if you don't have things coded. So you have to kind of take some time and think about how you want to code your data so that you can get the information out of it that you want. For instance, if you look at those nosocomial infection sites, you can see that there's UTIC, which is UTIs related to catheters, and then there's just the plain old UTI. So that was done for a specific reason, because this particular facility wanted to look at them in terms of whether they were catheter related or not. And you have to think about that as you're designing your data collection tools and putting your data into your storage tool, whether it's a database or a spreadsheet program. The next slide is just an example of what you can do in Excel. For smaller facilities, I think Excel has some real good advantages. It's off the shelf. Most people have Excel with their Microsoft package at their facility. This is what we call a pivot table. The data that you just saw on the previous line listing has been summarized by the month of the year going across the top. And then down the side, you can see the organisms that were isolated from those infections. And at the top, you can see that you can, in addition, sort this by sex or unit. So you could look at your infections by month of the year, by bug, by the unit, or by the sex of the patient. If you look across there, you can see a line that says MRSA. Basically, what that is a summary of the MRSA isolates for each month in this whole data set. If you move to the next slide, what we want to do is take that numerator data, which is the number of isolates of MRSA, and turn that into some information in terms of a rate. So you can then take that information. There's ways to do this in Excel, but I do a lot of cutting and pasting. Cut that numerator data in, add the patient days and then calculate a rate of MRSA per 1,000 patient days, which gives you a lot more information than when you just say we had one of these and two of these and three of those and four of that of those. A good example is you can see that in this particular data set, two isolates per month, not a significantly different rate, but for August and November, gave you a slightly different rate based on the number of patient days during that time frame. Next step is to actually put this in a display that tells people something. If you give people data that's in a chart, sometimes it's not really clear to them what is the message. So what you want to do is get this into some kind of a format that's visual, that people can see. And the simpler the visual display, the better. This particular example, this is your MRSA rate per 1,000 patient days from the previous chart. And what we've done is created a run chart with a median line and then actually annotated this to say that, you know, at that particular point in time there in June, we were seeing an MRSA outbreak in our nursing homes in our community, and maybe that might have had something to do with that peak that occurred in July. So this is a lot better information than if you just showed somebody the tabular data that was in the previous slide. On this next slide, I just want to go over the next two slides. I want to talk about the components of a graphic display of data. The first slide talks about just the different components. I'm going to move on to the display that's annotated and talk about the importance of making sure that your displays of data are labeled accurately. So if you look at the anatomy of a graphic display of data slide, you can see that this particular slide has several different components. You have a y-axis label, and you want to make sure that y-axis is labeled because sometimes it's a percent of cases, sometimes it's a rate, sometimes it's a number. And if you don't label that, people are not going to know what they're looking at. Many cases, you want to have an x-axis label. Sometimes it's intuitive. Sometimes that label, those individual labels will be months of the year, so you don't have to put months of the year underneath because people will understand what that is. But if it's not intuitive, you may want to, particularly in this example where you've got categorical data, you may want to put job category so people understand what that is. There's a plot area to every display, and this is particularly in Excel. Every display should have a legend, particularly if you have more than one line or bar on that particular display. And then most importantly, and this is something that I see very commonly, is that people do not put a title on their display that is reflective of what they're looking at. That title really has to tell you everything. It needs to tell you who, what, where, sometimes why, and when, the when of the data that's been collected. And this one's pretty good because it tells you that it's figure one, it's the job categories, it's in this hospital, and these are the years, and it's shown as a percent of total cases. And this one also gives the ends or the denominator information, which sometimes can be important or be a question that people ask. You can annotate these charts also with how you collected the data, what your surveillance methodology is also. The more information you can put on a graphical display, the better off you will be, because you have to remember that sometimes people will copy visual displays and give them to other people, and you won't be there to explain it. So you want to make sure that that display of information can stand alone and explains everything that's on the chart with you without somebody having to be there to explain what's there. The next slide I want to show you is basically just kind of giving you a summary of the types of graphs and charts you can use to display data. It's very important to make sure that you use the appropriate display based on the type of data that you have. And we don't have a lot of time today to go into the detail here, but this is just a summary from a biostatistics course put on by the Centers for Disease Control. It kind of summarizes when you use a pie chart, when you use a bar chart, when you use a histogram, when you use a line graph. But it's very important to make sure that you use the right type of a display for the data that's there. I had an episode one time where I had displayed something in a pie chart totally appropriately, which was the percentage of the types of infections displayed by percentages. The typical, you know, 33% UTIs, 50% lower respiratory, 10% bloodstream infections graph. I gave that pie chart to someone in senior administration, and it immediately became obvious to me that this person did not know how to look at this thing because she said that, "Oh my gosh, look at that. our infection rate for UTIs is really high. And she didn't really understand that what she was looking at was the breakdown of our 10 infections over the last year. So sometimes you have to do a little bit of education of the people that you're giving the display to so that they know how to interpret the information. Just to kind of quickly go over these different types of displays, bar charts are used basically when you want to display a summary of information for different categories of a variable. It allows you to look at the magnitude between those categories of data, and you can display bar charts either vertically or horizontally. Typically, what we do is we see data displayed in vertical bar charts. The next slide is an example of a bar chart. This is actually right from one of the MMWRs, the Centers for Disease Control publication that does the epidemiological surveillance for the United States. This particular bar chart is pertussis reported cases by age group in the United States in 2002. And you can see on the left-hand side, there's a label that said that we're looking at numbers, we're not looking at rates. The categories are labeled each individually, and then there's a label on the x-axis that tells you that these are age groups in years, not by months, which is very important. And at the bottom, there's some annotation of the fact that some of these did not have ages and talked about some of the reported cases in terms of vaccination. So it's a very simple data display, but it's very clear what you're looking at. You're looking at numbers, you're looking at age groups for the year of 2002 in the United States, and you're looking at pertussis cases. So it's pretty self-explanatory. The next kind of display is a histogram. Histograms are used to display the frequency distribution for categories of a variable. So we're looking at frequency distributions. Histograms are typically the display that's used when you're looking at epidemic curves for an outbreak. And if we go to the next slide, you can see an example of an epidemic curve of a person-to-person transmitted outbreak. This is just an example of what the display looks like. As you can see, this is not a very good display because it really doesn't have enough detailed information. The y-axis is labeled, it says number of cases, but not really well visualized. The epidemic curve, it has days of the week, but it doesn't say what the time frame is. So this is kind of an example of what the histogram looks like, but it's not a real good example of a display, just to kind of show you the contrast between displays. If someone was to put this in a file drawer in their office and somebody was to pull this out in 10 years, they would not have any clue what this was about because it doesn't talk about what the infection was or what the condition was, and it has no time frame at all on it. Next type of display is a pie chart. Pie charts display proportions of each category of a variable. We do use pie charts sometimes in infection control just to kind of get an idea of what proportion of our infections are in different categories. This is an example of one for the National Nosocomial Infection Study on the next slide. This is a breakdown by urinary tract, surgical site, pneumonia, primary bloodstream, and other sites of infection. This is from the semiannual report in December of 2002. And as you can see, the pie sections are different colors. If you don't have color printer, you might want to make those sections into different grid hatch marks or dots or those kinds of things, because when you print color that looks like this, it usually comes out different shades of gray and it's hard to interpret. The next slide, I just want to talk a little bit about this whole idea of three-dimensional displays. Three-dimensional displays look really slick when you're doing a slide program. But unfortunately, what three-dimensional displays do is in some ways they distort the data. If you look at that section of the pie that's towards the front, which is the lower respiratory component, that component is 30% of the pie, as well as the bloodstream infection, which is 30% of the pie towards the rear. But if you really look closely, the lower respiratory part looks bigger, and that is the problem with 3D pie charts. The pieces that are in the front tend to look bigger than those in the back, even though the percentages are the same. So what I tell people and what the references in the back of the presentation will talk to you about is to be very careful when you do 3D displays because sometimes they distort the data. Now that can be to your advantage if you're trying to kind of skew the data a little bit, but for the most part they're not a good way to go. This next slide is an example of an exploded 3D pie chart, which is an even more distorted view of the information. And you can see here it's very pretty, but it's not really a good way to represent information. Now let's move on to the next slide to line graphs, run charts, and control charts. Control charts are kind of the gold standard now for a lot of infection control data. I'm not going to be able to spend a lot of time going into the nuances of control charts, but I just want to kind of give you an overview of the distinctions between these different types of data displays. Run charts do not include any kind of statistical calculations. They're just rates. So what you're doing is looking at rates over time. The x-axis is your continuous variable, which is either the time element or account, and then you want your y-axis to always start with zero. I was in a meeting about 2 days ago where someone had a y-axis that started at zero. The representation was for percentage, and they had a bar at the top that was 110%. And I said, well, when are we ever going to meet 110%? We need to take that line off. So you have to be real careful about your y-axis and how you display that information. The next slide just has sort of a representation of how you take that line listing data, transform it into a run chart. And this is just a simple run chart, number of infections associated with VRE over a period of time. On the next slide, you see another run chart, which actually has a mean line superimposed on it. And all this is just, once again, it's just a simple run chart. The left-hand side is the number of minutes. This is representing average wait time in minutes to see a physician in the emergency department. If you look at this very closely, you have no idea what the time frame is for this. You've got days of the week at the bottom, but you do not have any indication of what year this is, what week it is. So this really isn't, if you look at the top, you don't have your when very clearly defined. Next chart is a representation, and once again, this is from MMWR, talking about foodborne botulism. Once again, this is a simple run chart, but it's also annotated. Annotated means that you have some explanation on the run chart about what was occurring at the time that you see peaks or valleys in the chart. So on this particular chart, you see that there was an outbreak caused by sautéed onions in Illinois, an outbreak caused by fermented fish in Alaska. You also have an outbreak, baked potatoes in Texas, and then another outbreak at the end caused by chili sauce in Texas. This is a very good display. It's got the year. It's got the annotation on it. The y-axis is well labeled, as well as the x-axis, and then a little bit of explanation about what the disease is and a little bit of information about it. On the next slide, I'm going to start talking a little bit about control charts. The distinction between a run chart and a control chart is that a control chart has some statistical calculations built into it. Those statistical calculations are described as basically standard deviations and are representations of the variation in the data. This particular control chart is a catheter-related urinary tract infection at Whoville Nursing Home. The title is not very well done because it doesn't have a time frame on it. The y-axis is labeled quite well, right, rate per 1,000 catheter days, and then you've got your dates across the bottom. The middle dotted line is your mean. The upper control limit typically is 3 standard deviations from the mean for that set, particular set of data. There is a lower control limit for this chart, but it is below 0, so there's no need to put that lower control limit on there. The upper control limit is your panic level, basically, is what it amounts to. And so in this particular chart, we have two points at which someone would say, we're above our upper control limit. We probably have something that is not common cause variation, and we need to look into it. So that's the power of the control chart, is that you have some statistical calculation related to your data built into the display. It makes it easier to interpret the information. Now let's just talk about putting some of these things together. Many of you work in hospitals where they may be talking, or facilities where they may be talking about dashboards, instrument panels, and balanced scorecards. And these are just tools that are used to put a lot of information together in a way that people can make simple interpretations of what's going on in their facility. This first slide is a picture of a dashboard, and I just want to walk you through a little bit about this dashboard. Dashboards are a really nice way to take data that may be somewhat confidential. For instance, these are rates of infection by unit, and translate it into a format that a floor nurse can actually understand. So on this particular display, you see nosocomial infections, intravascular device-related bloodstream infections, and then the units go across the top. Each one of the boxes is colored red, yellow, or green, and those are determined basically based on the NIS percentiles. So if it's red, it's above the NIST 75th percentile. If it's green, it's below the 50th percentile. You can put these displays up in a nursing unit. You don't have to worry about the fact that you have the actual rate there, and maybe they'll go to a cocktail party and talk about that rate. But you do have an indication to them that, you know, if it's red, we have a problem here. We need to be working on our process measures to and interventions to decrease the rate. So these are really nice displays. I've used them particularly for nursing staff so that they have an idea of what their infection rate looks like and what their process measures are doing. The next slide is an annotated run chart, and this is a more complex run chart. This particular one, I want to thank Robert Garcia because this is a run chart from the project he's been working on at his facility for, I think, about 5 years now, where they have gone through this progressive decrease in their central venous catheter-related bloodstream infections. If you look at this particular chart, you can see that the left-hand side, the y-axis is labeled cases per 1,000 catheter days. You've got your months of the year across the bottom. And then what looks like two intervention periods. You've got a period when they were using the AeroGuard Blue catheter, and that's an annotation on this chart, and then a period where they were using a Vantex catheter. They've also done some things. They did some educational programs. They had a catheter replacement policy revision, and then the final intervention that they had in those annotations was the use of ChloraPrep. And you can watch their infection rate over time decrease, consistently decrease, and I just was with him at the national conference, and this rate is unbelievably low now because of some other interventions that they have put into place. But this is a great display because you can look at this and you can see what they did and what effect it had. I always find it interesting to see the education program annotation, and you can see the rates go down, and then you stop educating, and they go back up again. So there were some other interventions on here that were somewhat more permanent, particularly the ChloraPrep intervention that occurred in March of 2002. So this is a very good display and can be shared with lots of people and is very self-explanatory. Another kind of display that some administrative staffs are using now is what they call a spider chart. This is something that can be done in a simple program like Excel. On this particular dashboard display, they picked two indicators in each of five different domains, and these are the domains of quality as defined by the Institute of Medicine, that care is effective, safe, patient-centered, efficient, and timely, as well as equitable, although they don't have measures for equitable. You can see equitable kind of hanging out there on the side. They've picked two indicators in each one of these areas. For instance, under emergency department length of stay, and then they've got percent of appointments in less than 2 weeks. If you look at that, the area that's shaded, that is the area that you want to see going all the way out to the edge of the spider diagram. So if that goes all the way out, that means that they are doing really well. So in the timeliness, compliance is low. You can see there for percent of appointments less than 2 weeks, there looks like at about 75%. ED length of stay percent is greater than 6 hours. That looks like it's a little bit lower than that. So these are really quick displays that are really good for board-level communications where you're not really wanting to talk about the detail behind all this stuff, but you do want to give them a sense of where the hospital is on some big groupings of indicators. I'm going to move on from data to presentation and talk a little bit about reporting. When you're taking the data that you've translated into tabular or graphical displays, there's more to just giving them the chart that you got out of Excel. You really have to do a little bit more than that. Although the first step, obviously, is that you want to get that display to look really good. You want to select the data that you're going to present. One thing that I tell people is really important is before you start messing with your data, you want to make sure that you have a clear picture in your mind of what you're trying to create before you start to create it with some kind of automated tool. It's very important to do that ahead of time because all may not seem to appear what it's supposed to look like. This is just an example of all may not be what it seems. If you look at this horizontal line depiction, I haven't had any beer yet today, but that looks kind of crooked to me. But those lines are actually parallel. The point I'm trying to make with that is that sometimes you need to look at your data very closely, or data displays that other people do very closely. This next example is an example of how you can change your data display to make your data look the way you want it to. And I'm not suggesting that you do that, but you have to be careful because sometimes people will ask you to change your data display to make a particular point. In this example, you can see on the top left-hand side, you have needle sticks per 1,000 patient days at St. Elsewhere Hospital. The important point here is to look at that y-axis. The range on that y-axis is from 0 to 50 needle sticks per 1,000 patient days. If you look at the next graph in the right-hand corner at the bottom, it's the same exact information displayed with a different y-axis. Okay, so you can see that on that y-axis we're going from 0 to 9. In November of 2003, it looks like we had a pretty serious problem, when in fact, on the other graph, it looks like there wasn't too much of a blip at all. So it's very important to make sure that you look at the data that you're trying to represent, or look at the display that somebody else has given you to make sure that there's no misrepresentation going on. So let's talk a little bit about data graphics principles. The first thing is you want to make sure you show the data, that you're not misrepresenting it and that you're showing everything that you have. You want to maximize your data to ink ratio. If you look at that previous slide, you can see that on the one graph where they had the large range on their y-axis, you have not maximized the data ink ratio, which means that you've misrepresented the information. That y-axis should really, the top of the y-axis should really be the largest value in your data set. The other thing I just want to make sure that you understand is that the data display is a work in progress. So you're going to be working on this for a while, and it may take you a while to get to the point that you're trying to make, but you want to spend some time working on that. I'm going to skip through these next three slides, just in interest of time. I want to talk a little bit about visuals in your presentation. You want to make sure that those visuals in your presentation enhance your message. They actually aid in comprehension. I've actually been in several presentations where people give you too much information and it actually muddies up the water and distracts from the message that's trying to be put across. Simple, less is more. Keep in mind that a simple display that's done really well can convey your message sometimes much more effectively than if you've got something that has a lot of busyness on it. You want to make sure you use your color, typeface, and clip art very carefully, and you always want to keep asking the question, how is this going to reinforce my message? What's the point that I'm trying to make with this presentation? Moving on to the next slide, who is your audience? This is very important. Every time you do a presentation, you want to make sure that you've asked, in the eyes of your audience, what's in it for them? What is it that they want to know about your message and what's going to be important to them? For instance, administration is typically looking at information from the perspective that they have to make a decision. Physicians want things to look easy. They want to be able to look at it easily and decipher what's there. They don't want to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what you're trying to say. Clinical staff are typically looking for, how am I going to get this done? So you want to frame your display in that context in terms of how can they get this done. Non-clinical staff many times want to know why it's important. So they may not be as interested in the data, but they want to understand why you're talking to them about whatever it is you're displaying. So you have to look at their likely response to the information. You want to look at your audience's past behavior and experience. If you've had a bad experience with somebody looking at data, you may not want to give them data. If you have someone that is very data-driven, you want to make sure you give them the right data. You may give them a data display as well as the chart behind the data. But always keep in mind that you want to keep in mind for them the what's in it for me proposition. So it's very important to make sure that you take that into consideration. It is not a one-report-fits-all world. You need to make sure that the report that you've designed is specific to the audience that you're going to be giving it to. Many times we create our monthly reports, and that's the monthly report that goes out to everybody. I think that we can be a lot more effective if we think about what display would be most appropriate for what audience, instead of trying to create a one-size-fits-all report every month. In terms of data display, just to summarize, make sure that you know your audience and you know what you want your audience to understand from your display. You want to make sure you track their attention with your display. And if you've got data that's not compelling, it's not really telling the story that you want to tell, don't show it to them. You want to use the appropriate display type, and I think I sent to you that one chart that was in the slide, Guide to Selecting a Graph or Chart to Display Data in a Large Format. Make sure you're using the right display type for the type of data that you're using. And you really want to only have one key message per visual display. You don't want to muddy up the water with a bunch of messages for every display. So really the purpose of your data display is to provide a historical record. It's support for planning and decision making. It might be used for public relations. It also might be used for disseminating information to other people. And in addition, as we all know, we have those compliance things that we have to do to be compliant with regulations. You can actually think of a data display as a research paper in some respects, or a data presentation. And I just put in here the research paper analogy, but you want to make sure that you've defined all these things. Every time you do a presentation, you want to make sure that you have all of these components in your presentation. They may be named something different, but the bottom line is that you want to define all of these points: who, where, when, what, how, criteria for including those people or events in your data, what's your numerator and your denominator, a discussion of how you did the work, what the limitations of the data are, your recommendations, and then finally disseminating it to people. The best way to get your message across is to write recommendations at the end of your presentation so that people know what it is that you're trying to get across. Graphic presentations, the purpose of them is to synthesize and summarize data in a way that's easily understood by your intended audience so that they're empowered to take action. You're not the person that's necessarily always going to take action on infection control data. It may be someone else. So you want to make sure that you summarize it and present it in a way that they can take action easily. Some of the things that, in terms of graphic output options, there's handouts, there's presentation books or flip and tells. Black and white overheads can be used, color overheads and 35 millimeter slides. But most people, when they're doing presentations now, use the screen shows in programs such as PowerPoint. Real quickly, I just want to talk about benchmarking. And basically, benchmarking is the process of comparing yourself to others performing similar activities so that you can continuously improve. The word benchmark has been grossly abused in the last few years. A benchmark is the best. Sometimes we use the word benchmark to say that we're comparing ourselves to someone else that's a mean, but benchmark is best practice. Benchmarking requires that people are using the same criteria to define their cases. The criteria is applied consistently, and your surveillance methodology as well is consistent. Rates and ratios are calculated the same, and that you have a large enough denominator to say that you have a good sample, and that they also include standardized risk adjustment. There are very few systems that can claim that they do this really well. NIST is one of them because they have all these criteria, but there are many other benchmarking systems that cannot say that they have all these components. So be very careful when you're trying to benchmark yourself against someone else, because you really have to make sure that you've met all of these requirements to say that you're comparing yourself apples to apples. The next slide is talking about the process of using data to improve care, and this is actually on a site called talkingquality.gov, and it really just goes through the whole process of how you use data to actually improve care, and we've talked a little bit about that, but you really want to make sure that you've considered the methods to make your information more manageable. You want to make sure that you provide your audience with a meaningful point of comparison. And then finally, what's worth presenting? Sometimes the information that you have really isn't worth presenting because it doesn't have a story in it. Next slide is talking about communication. And obviously, this is the most important thing in relation to getting your message out. But you want to make sure you ask two questions. The first one is, so what? So what? What is the big deal with what you're trying to present? If you can't answer that question, then you may need to reconsider whether or not you want to present that information. So you want to present what's so, this is the way it is, and then you want to answer the question, so what? Why is this important? You want to communicate that information to those that are most affected first. You want to make sure that the implications of the information are understood. You want to respect the audience and their time and their capability to interpret the information that you're trying to give them. And always making sure that we get more and more skills in terms of how to communicate to people. Communication is the number one reason why we have adverse events in hospitals. And the more we can do to improve communication from the standpoint, inter-healthcare provider communications, but as well as those things where we're trying to communicate a message with our data. And lastly, I just want to emphasize that the more you plan, the better your report is going to be, and the more a change you're going to be able to implement in your facility. You want to have those clearly defined goals and objectives and answer the five W's and the H, the who, what, where, why, and when, and then the how. The more you do that, the better off you will be, and your reports will be very effective. The last slide is just a little cartoon about planning. Yes, we both agree this is a great place to catch flies. However, I'd like to point out a small flaw in your plan, the little fly sitting on the toilet seat. Not exactly a good place to be sitting to catch flies. And finally, I just want to summarize that the goal of presentation of data is to synthesize and summarize data in a way that's easily understood by the intended audience so that they are empowered to take action. It's not about producing reports just to produce reports. It's about empowering other people to take action and improve health care. The Joint Commission Information Management Standards, once again, talk about use of data. JCHO IM Standard 4.10 EP3 talks about use of infection control data, and that's what they're trying to get at, is the fact that we need to take that data, transform it into information and knowledge that impacts the quality of care. And I'm done.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. I'm glad you talked fast.
I did talk very fast.
That was a lot of information to pack in there. It's really very useful. I have a quick question, and then I'm afraid I'm going to have to close, but we'll get to that in a sec. The background color for charts and graphs. One of your charts in your presentation had a blue background and I think either black or white bars and text. How important is the background color, and do you have one that you recommend or just white?
Yes, the background color is important. When you're printing off documents, many times these software packages will put a gray background automatically on the back of a line chart or a bar chart. You want to change that to white if you're printing on a black and white printer. If you are displaying something visually up on a slide projector, the best color to use is that blue. There's been a lot of studies done. Use blue with white lettering or blue with a pale yellow lettering, and that's much more easily visualized by people that are in a large room looking at slides on a screen.
I'm glad I asked that question.
Yeah, and actually that information is found in, I forget which one of the reference, I think it's the Coslin reference, Elements of Graphic Design.
Good. Just before we close, I'd like to acknowledge a guy who's listening to the teleclass today. I met a fellow named Alan Soden at the recent APIC conference. In that short time, I have come to be really impressed with the vision that he has for helping ICPs communicate their message to other healthcare professionals and to people in the community. I think we're going to hear a lot more from this guy, and I just wanted to make mention of him so you can keep your ears open. Thank you all for joining our teleclass today. A special thank you to Bonnie for a really great presentation. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome, and thank you for inviting me. I really had a good time.
Well, I'm glad of that. Until we meet again, everyone, that'll be in 2 weeks' time. Goodbye.